Welcome to the Dork Forest. Jackie and her pals will never bore us. Shameless confessions
about our obsessions
will make us laugh and smile. So let's explore the Dork Forest and dork out for a while.
Hey, it's Jackie Cash and welcome to the Dork Forest. Intros are hard. I have a new album. You should be listening to it. I have a new hour. You could be watching it on YouTube, but I appreciate you listening to this, The Dork Forest. You could go to JackieCasia.com or TheDorkForest.com, and you can listen to it there. You can listen to it on wherever you're listening to it right now. You can watch it on YouTube separately, and that is where Altercation is also streaming. The album is available wherever you listen to any kind of album, and it's also on Bandcamp, which has a bunch of other, some very old Dork Forest that are free on that channel. Otherwise, you should know that the Dork Forest is, I don't have a Patreon, so feel free to donate. If you have $100 a year, I would love $100 a year from everybody. You can hand me a sweaty wad of 20s when you come and see me do stand-up, or you can email me or Venmo me. The email would be PayPal, jackie@jackiecation.com, where you can also email me. And Venmo is just @jackiecation, which is like my Instagram and my TikTok and all the things. And there's merch. There's Dork Forest merch. There's Made of Bees merch. And I don't know. There's so much stuff. I can't remember everything. You're doing vital work by listening to the Dork Short Forest, and I'm glad you are. And I hope you want to hear about somebody's dorkdom, because that's what's going to happen right now. Rangers, it's me, Jackie Cation, returning to the show, not probably a decade later, with other information, other things that he loves. It's Will Wheaton. Welcome to the program, Will Wheaton.
Hey, Jackie. Isn't it interesting Hello. How you can say it's probably been a decade, and even if it hasn't, it, like, boy, has it been.
It's been more than a decade. Yeah, this and the past decade. The only reason I know it's been more than a decade is because we have never discussed the shit show that is America.
And in fact,
it would have been more than a decade.
Yeah, and I quit drinking 10 years ago, and it was like I was back here, and I was like, hey, let's talk about homebrewing beer. And then, like, I don't know, 2 months later, I was like, hey, guess what? I'm an alcoholic. It's time to get sober.
I can't possibly
talk about drinking beer anymore.
And it's funny because I asked you to do it again, like, moments later, and you said, I can talk about bread. It's a lot like beer.
Boy, it was a real heartbreaking moment for me when I went to the refrigerator to get my starter out and kind of, like, you know, go back in. And the starter was like, so I am basically a colony of misery and rotting, fetid.
We're done. Yeah.
Going directly into the trash. You're not.
Right.
You're not
gonna do this. My mother-in-law had sourdough starter for 45 years. She passed away about a year and a half ago. She lived with us. And, and I was so surprised because it was my task to make some sourdough thing with her. I don't bake. So we did something every 2 weeks. We made English muffins. Yeah. We made banana bread. We made whatever. And so when she passed away, I was like, oh no, this is going to, I'm going to have to keep this sourdough alive for the rest of my marriage. Yeah. And Andy was like, you know, this isn't very good, sourdough starter. Let's start over. And I was like, what? Why start over at all? What's happening? And so we sent away to King Arthur. My sister sent us a new sourdough starter. So it's a great story. That's how it ends, by the way.
I was just visiting. My wife and I just went up to Moab a number of years ago when we were still. when did we do this? We did this in like 2021, maybe. We went out on this road trip where we rented a van that's kind of like, I forget what they call them, but they're like, they're little self-contained vans. They're kind of like
caravan.
Caravan. Yeah. And we drove from LA all the way up to Moab, and we hit a bunch of national parks on the way.
Where's Moab?
Moab is in Utah. It's in northern central Utah. And, we did a bunch of national parks. It was great. And, my tattoo artist and her wife live in Moab. I had been working on getting a tattoo filled in here in LA. Kim would come down to work here. and I'd been getting work done, and I'm doing a sleeve on this arm, and I had a cuttlefish that like was ready to go. And we got to this place in my arm, and my body was like, dude, no more. I'm done for today. We had been in session. She'd been tattooing me for like 3 or 4 hours. So,
oh my gosh.
I was like, it's okay. I will come back in like a week or so. And then the lockdowns happened and I didn't go back until 3 weeks ago. Ann and I went up to Moab.
Oh my gosh. Did you have half a cuttlefish?
I did. Let me see if I can. So like this was just an outline, but you can sort of see, and I have tiny baby arms. But like, yeah, we did all this color and like, this is the worst, longest pain I've ever been in. It was so brutal.
Oh, that inside.
While we were getting it done, Ann sat with us, right? And this relates to sourdough bread, I promise. Ann was sitting with me and holding my hand. And when it was, you know, like, it was bad, you know? And like, that's okay. It's part of it. Like, you know, it's part of earning your tattoo.
I guess.
And I'm like going through it. And Kim finally finishes that part and I like exhale and Anne brings up her hand and it's just kind of like this twisted, smashed down thing because I've been squeezing it so hard.
Oh my gosh.
so like my brain is like, talk about something, go someplace. And I'm like, hey Kim, remember something about sourdough bread? And we start talking about that. Anyway, I lamented that my starter died. She was like, we have an incredible starter. And I did not know until she told me this just a few days, like a couple weeks ago, that you can dehydrate them. You can take all the, and you basically just get this kind of like thin kind of like cracker sort of thing that you just hold on, right?
Oh, and then you can restart it anytime kind of thing?
And you can use it to restart your sourdough starter. So,
which is probably what King Arthur does.
Probably, yeah. So I'm going to get a piece of her starter and be able to bring it back around. And I've really missed it. You know, I started doing that in the early days of the pandemic. And I think a lot of us did. We were just like, look, you know, this is a slow, deliberate process. we're spending time kind of like we're building something and we're working with something that's alive. And there's food at the end of it, which felt very important back here. Back then.
Yeah, yeah. And will again. Yes.
I really enjoyed it. It was really fun. And then like you can do all, I found about all the stuff that you can do with like sourdough starter discard and Kim gave me this recipe to make sourdough starter discard corn dogs where you use.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, man. Like it's just, turns out I can still talk about making sourdough bread.
I was going to say we're on like 5-6 minutes in and we're talking sourdough starter. Yeah. But it's interesting. By the way, I'm talking with Will Wheaton. You know Will Wheaton from his career. In other news, he has a new podcast. It's called It's Storytime. And if you go to willwheaton.net, and Will has one L in it, willwheaton.net, it'll have all the information on this stuff. It's Storytime is the podcast. He's doing a new narration. You did a new narration of The Body, which is the short story that Stand By Me was based on.
Yes.
And then you're also touring a little bit with Stand By Me, the movie, and doing a Q&A after, right?
Yeah.
Two more dates on the books?
I do. Earlier this year, I had a real Stand By Me moment. It was cool. The movie's 40 years old this year.
Right, right.
We filmed in 1985, and then it came out in a limited release in August of 1986. Mm-hmm. And then it went into a wide release a little bit later, right around Labor Day that year. Right. And because it's the 40th anniversary, a friend of Jerry's has been doing some shows with a company called Mills Entertainment, who I've come to actually really, really like and really enjoy working with. And they do these shows where they're bringing together people who worked on what are now considered classic movies or beloved television shows, screening them for an audience and then doing a Q&A, moderated Q&A, that kind of thing, right?
It is a classic. It was 40 years ago, disappointingly enough. But
it's so weird.
I was a sentient adult when I watched that movie and loved you. So
thank
hooray
you.
For me.
I was this so December was when we started this little tour, right? And we did a few shows in New England. We kind of wanted to warm up, the three of us, Jerry and Corey and myself. We wanted to sort of warm up and see, like, does this work? Are we enjoying this? Will this be something we want to do a bunch of times next year? Let's just try it out and see. No expectations. The three of us have not been together since production. We talk every now and then. Corey and I have crossed paths a few times at pop culture conventions. Jerry is a voice actor on Star Trek Lower Decks. I hosted the Ready Room for Paramount for many, many years.
Jerry's awesome.
Rebecca is on Strange New World. So we have that like Star Trek colleague kind of thing. It's very fun when Jerry points out that in the Star Trek world, he outranks me. Because he's a captain and I'm not, and I always have to remind him that I'm no longer in Starfleet. I'm a traveler of all space and time, and
it turns out you're a genius. You're above it all. You're like more than Q right now.
So we went and we did the show. We did these shows, and like it was like no time had passed. It was crazy. It was so much fun. The three of us getting together and just reconnecting and kind of meeting each other as adults. And reliving those wonderful, wonderful days that we spent in production and like remembering River Phoenix and remembering Rob Reiner. And the thing is, like, we were on tour. We did three shows and we were in a tour bus between cities at, you know, like 6 to 7 hours a day driving from city to city. And it was this concentrated time of the three of us just kind of like rebonding and all that. And then talking about the movie for these audiences that love it. There's nothing like being in that audience with people who have never seen it before or kids who've only seen it on TV and they're seeing it in a theater with their parents. So we were up there doing these shows and they were great. And we were so incredibly excited to come back and do more this year. And we got home and a couple of days later, Rob was killed. And we, every one of us had expected that at some point this year, we'll do a show with him, you know, I mean, even if it's not one of our tour stops, we would definitely be interviewed.
Right.
Something like there's something's going to happen. And it ended up happening with People Magazine. And he wasn't there.
I am so sorry for your loss, man. That's heartbreaking.
Thanks, man. I really appreciate that.
You know,
he really meant a lot to me. And the thing is that's such a wonderful gift is that we had been together, the three of us.
Yeah.
In a way, with him in 1985 again.
Right.
For 3 days.
Right.
And the experiences that we had all had, we had just talked about them like crazy. Right. And like we had really been together with that. So we had this place where we could land when Rob was killed. And we had this place where we could like, thank God there's somebody else that I talk to now regularly who knows what this feels like.
Right.
And it was a real blessing that we got to do that. These shows have been wonderful. They've been so much fun. I'd never seen the movie in a theater beyond the casting
first
screening because when I went, I was too young. I was underage. I couldn't buy a ticket to an R-rated movie. I remember standing and arguing. I remember like 13-year-old me arguing with like, you know, the 15-year-old ticket taker at the movie theater. I was like, I'm in the movie.
And they're like,
right? And they're like, you can't come in.
It's, no gatekeeper.
I will
gatekeeper.
Not sell you a ticket.
Yeah. That's ridiculous. Can I buy a movie? Here's my thing. Why didn't you just buy a ticket for the movie next door and then go into it?
Because this was so long ago. It was a movie theater that only showed one movie.
Oh,
remember those days? Remember those days where there would be like six showtimes on the marquee and that was it?
And granted, I grew up in suburban and rural Wisconsin and we had multiplexes.
We had multiplexes too in my little suburban. I lived in the San Fernando Valley. I lived in a little tiny community called Sunland Tohunga, and we had one theater.
Right, and that was the only. And you were 13, and that was the one you could get to. Yes, as a 13-year-old.
Yeah,
it's a. Oh, I because I yeah the movie going from when I was about 13 to when I was about, I would say 17, I would take like three buses and spend the entire day at the multiplex and just go see all of the movies.
Yep. Work your way through. Yeah, sure.
I was alone a lot. Let's welcome to the Dork Forest, Will Wheaton. By the way, we're going to talk about your new hobby. Is it new?
Not really. This is a hobby that snuck up on my wife and me.
You're doing it together.
And it has slowly, I wouldn't say that it's taken over our lives. I think it's probably more accurate to say that this has enhanced and seasoned our lives and given us this thing that, you know, I had been told by so many people, this is going to happen someday. I'll be 54 in July. And since I was right around 50, I've been into this. And I've been told by my friends who are a little older than me, this happens to all of us. Like eventually it's just to what degree do you like dive into this? Are you casual or are you like negative work about it?
Wait, your friends think that absolutely everyone at some point will get into birds?
Yeah. Yeah. at some point in your life. And it doesn't matter how much, right? I mean, it can be very casual. It can be incredibly casual. It can be like, oh, yeah, I put up a feeder in the backyard and like there's a bunch of
finches. I don't think you're wrong.
Right?
I think you are correct.
Yeah. Yeah.
I have a couple of friends who are like me,
where I'm like, Ann, come to the window. There's a dark eyed junco in the yard.
Not a dark eyed junco.
That's a bad example because I haven't yet seen the dark eyed juncos that are in the neighborhood. I hear them every evening. With the Merlin app, right?
Okay.
And I'm like, what is that? Because I'm starting to recognize bird calls, and I'm like, that's a blah blah blah. That, you know what, whatever.
There's an app. And,
there's an app from Cornell University. It's wonderful. There are two apps that I think are really terrific. One is called Merlin. It passes the privacy checks and the vibe checks and all of that. And it's amazing. It's like, it helps you identify by song or visually, or you can even describe through kind of a 20 questions flow, like what you just saw, and it will show you pictures and be like, is this your bird? and then when you see a bird, you can add it to your list. So you start to build a bird book of all the birds that you've seen. And, you know, I have a lot in my backyard that I really care about, very excited about.
Okay. So what's the other app as a quick.
The other app is called WhoBird. WHOBIRD. This is an open source app that is not available, as far as I know, in the primary like Play Store or whatever the Apple App Store is. I use an unlocked Android phone, and there's an alternate repository that lets you go through and find open source applications that have been peer reviewed, that are you know, audited and all of that. They're just not. They're not gross like a lot of, you know, they're not full of spyware like a lot of apps are. And actually, the reason that I went over to Merlin, Hoover's terrific. But the reason I switched over to Merlin is that Google changed their app policy and it will no longer work. You're going to have to unlock your bootloader, which like, okay, I can do it. I've done it, but I'd rather not. And we've now reached the part of me talking about things where you've discovered one of my superpowers, which is I can talk in extraordinary detail about something hours after you deeply regret casually commenting on the
film. Welcome to the Dork Forest, where you belong. So 20 years later, let us talk about all. It's a deep dive into. It's what I have is I have a shallow knowledge of a thousand things.
Like, yeah,
I can
too.
Tell you a little bit about cricket, but that's only because we did it. I did an episode. Yeah. So
I know.
So,
that,
but I like the idea of the Merlin app.
Call it a test.
I know that
cricket's called a test and it takes multiple days.
Oh, instead of a game?
Yeah, it's called a test. The matches are called tests. And I know that Kunal Niar from Big Bang Theory loves cricket. Loves All cricket right. the way I love ice hockey. Yeah, it was always really yeah. fun because he would be like watching cricket games on his phone, right? And he was like, oh, it's right. day three of the test or whatever. Like,
did you
can you imagine a sport that takes days to play and you just go and you're just like, so what are you doing next week? I'm going to go watch cricket. What else are you going to do? No, that's all I'm doing.
No, that's it. We're taking a break for tea and then we're going to sleep and then we're going to start again. Yeah. Will Anderson
we're
was
steal some artifacts from some indigenous people and put them in the British Museum. And then we're going to settle right back into our test.
I 2 weeks ago, I was in Berlin and we went to this old museum, this yeah. museum of ancient stuff. And they have yeah. the bust of Nefertiti. Which Get I had heard out. Of the bust of Nefertiti,
yeah,
but I had forgotten about the bust of Nefertiti until I yeah. saw the bust of Nefertiti. And then there's a card next to it that says acquired 1847. And I was like, acquired? I bet it was. I bet it was acquired.
It sure anyway, was.
When was it returned? Anyway, yeah. so let's also put that on the page. But Will Anderson was the episode of cricket. If anybody wants to go back. Will Anderson is a comic from Australia. He is Banana Land about cricket. And all I remember now is I now know what a wicket is and a sticky wicket. And and all they're doing is running back and forth between those poles. That's what I remember.
Yep.
And that's all I've got. But yeah. Merlin app, let's talk about the birds you've seen. Is it so you're mostly doing this in your backyard here in the Los Angeles area? Is that correct?
Yeah, we live in the
California.
Valley.
And, okay.
Yep, and so I told it where. So let me go back a couple of years.
Please.
We were out just walking. Ann and I were out walking. And I started to like just see the birds and say hi to the birds and, you know, that kind of thing. And then I started looking up after I would see a particular one, I would look them up and try to visually identify them, which is how I found out that we have, like here where we live, we have a lot of black phoebe, tons of house finches, some sparrows. Those are really, really common. We even get some robins here every now and then.
Oh, wow.
And at some point, a murder of crows moved into the neighborhood. And they,
we really have a murder started. Of crows.
Yeah.
Do you live in Van Nuys? Anyway,
no.
my grandmother used to hate crows and owls yeah. because she's Armenian and they are a portent. Okay. They are a portent. She didn't even know the English word portent, but yeah. my God, she knew that it was a portent.
You want to know something that's crazy? Speaking of portents, we 6 tomorrow it'll be 7 weeks ago our dog Marlo died. Aww. We'd had Marlo for 14 years.
Okay. What kind of dog was Marlo?
Marlo was a pit bull mix.
Okay.
And she was sorry my phone's going off to tell me
your phone wants to tell you stuff. Welcome to the world of tech nerd Will Wheaton. Okay, there we go.
My alarm goes off at 9:30 to remind me to take my antidepressants. And then it tells me a dad joke. And I knew that we were doing this interview at 9:30 when I have my antidepressants. So I already took them. And I thought I told my phone, do not interrupt me while I'm doing the Dork Forest podcast, please. And it was like, I have other ideas. Okay, so we lost Marlo. And it was devastating. And I'm still going through it. We're both still going through it.
Yeah, it's early.
And the day before, Marlo had cancer. And she was fine, and then she wasn't. And the night before, we took her to the vet because all of her lymph glands got massively inflamed. There was an owl on our chimney.
Okay.
Like, sitting
poor
on the
tent,
roof of our house.
Poor
like,
tent.
Sitting on the chimney. And I'd never, like, there are two owls who live in the neighborhood. I hear them talking to each other all the time. I've seen them three times. I've seen one of them three times. I don't believe in supernatural stuff. I don't believe in omens, and I don't believe in any of that. You know, I think that humans are remarkably good at pattern recognition, and we can retroactively apply things. And look, we love to tell stories, right? I mean, humans are storytellers. Sure. It's what we do. It's what I do as my life. I tell stories. Mm-hmm. So I get that. But it was just kind of odd to me. This owl was there, you know, and like on the chimney, and calling down into the chimney. Mm-hmm. I went outside and I looked at it up on the chimney, and it like looked right at me, and it sat there for a while, and then it flew over my head. And the thing about owls, if you're ever lucky enough to be close to one when they're flying, they're silent. They are absolutely silent. Not like, oh, you can barely hear the rustling of the feathers. No, they're silent. They can go creepy. Right over your head. Yep, they go right over your head, and you'll never know, right?
Yeah, I want to know.
So there was an owl up there, and we took her to the vet, and the vet was like, she's dying.
Right.
And we took her to, so a couple of days went by, we took her to see her oncologist. And the oncologist said, we can try this treatment. You know, she's a good candidate for chemo. And we were like, great, let's do it. And she started to get better. All of her lymph glands got small again. She was as happy and enthusiastic and energetic and everything. She was doing great. And then after a few days, there was an owl in the yard again. There just hasn't been owls in the yard. At all. Right. There was an owl right there.
I would like to blame it on the fucking owl. The owl is bringing this cancer. That's what's happening.
And the next day we had to put her to sleep.
Yep.
And, you know, I'm sure it's just a coincidence, but it makes a good story.
Makes an excellent story. We went in Berlin, we went to the Stasi Museum after we did an escape room. And you could be forgiven to be worried about what the theme of that escape room was. But and it wasn't great. It was East Berlin to West Berlin. And the escape room was near the Stasi Museum, which is the old East Berlin, East German police. Yeah. And the 26-year-old who had built this escape room was so proud of herself. She was like, doesn't it look real? And I was like, sadly, it does. Creep Factor 11. I am... uncomfortable that we have to figure out how to move the toilet so we can crawl through a tunnel to get to we started in an East Berlin studio apartment and ended up in a West Berlin toy store in 1984. Okay. And so there were AT-ATs on the ceiling and Millennium Falcon. And there was it was a floppy disk, but it wasn't the big one. It was the small plastic because they had
3.5-inch floppies. Yeah.
That's it. You had to put one of those into the Mac Classic to make one of the doors open.
Of course.
And I was like, it was incredibly well done. But then we went right after that, we went to the Stasi Museum.
Oh, by the way, here's this for real.
Right. And I am not a huge hippy skippy. Like I have some rocks. I don't mind a crystal, but it's, But we walked in, and I was like, I lasted 40 minutes. And I'm like, some real bullshit went down in this building, and I would like to leave. I did go to the gift shop and buy a tote. Anyway, owls. Do you know what kind of owl you saw? What kind of owl it was? Did you look up?
We're pretty sure that it was a great horned owl.
Oh, my gosh. That's a real...
Yeah, kind of like the boss monster of owls.
LA has so many birds.
The leader of the owls.
Yeah, like much like plants, everybody brought their weird birds here.
Yeah,
and the climate is such that almost any bird can live here. Like
at the moment, birds are migrating, and at the moment. The Orioles are in Southern California as they are on their migration. And just a couple of days ago, I saw one on the wire in the backyard. I was sitting on the patio reading a book and like, oh shit, there it is. I'm like, look at it. I'm like, oh my God. So it's gorgeous. I'm just like, and I'm you don't want to move too fast because you don't want to startle them. So I'm like, slowly trying to pick up my phone. And I pull it out and I get it open and I gently like kind of like point it up. And as soon as the phone goes up and it and the bird's in frame, it took off. And I'm like calling Anne, you got to come out.
I got to see you. Let's see. And wait a minute. So it's sort of orange and black and white.
Yeah, orange and black with sort of like white stripes down the side of its face. It's really beautiful. There are a couple of different
kinds
of species that come here. The one that the one that I saw is the hooded oriole. My favorite, absolute favorite bird species that I've been able to record in the backyard is called a scaly-breasted Munia. Munia. I don't know how it's M-U-N-I-A. And the thing about most birds, whoever named birds, the scientific names for birds, the ornithologists who did this around the world were super horny because every bird is some version of a tit, which is weird. this particular one
is Munia a word for boob?
I don't know. It might be.
Okay, because scaly, like,
scaly breasted Munia, but like they are
scaly breasted,
gorgeous. They're a real soft brown color, and then their breast is spotted black and white. And they have black eyes and like a real prominent beak. And I have bird feeders with cameras on them because of course I do. And
of course you want credit.
And these, you know, these showed up and like, I lost my mind. I was just like, I can't believe that we got these. I can't believe that it actually landed in the backyard and I got this picture of it. They're gorgeous. That is my favorite species just because they are so beautiful. And they show up regularly. The orioles are really nice too.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. It's,
and then we have a couple of hawks that come out in the neighborhood.
Okay.
We've got a Cooper's hawk, a red shouldered hawk. And, I think those are the two that we've been able to.
Are they pretty big hawks? I always think of hawks because they, I remember when Marie Bamford, a friend of mine, and she got her first pug, and the guy was like, "You have to not let the pug out in the yard alone because of hawks and owls."
My and son and like, his wife. Yes. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, that was the end of the story. That good news. An owl never came and stole her pug. Okay.
My son and his wife. Had a teacup chihuahua who was the runt of her litter, and Charlie weighed 5 pounds. And she just passed too. We loved her so much.
Oh my God. She didn't get snatched.
She was so little they live in Arizona, and she is so little that she couldn't go out into the backyard by herself because it was very risky that a raptor would come down and grab her.
Yeah. 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 And we also have coyotes in our neighborhood. The dumbest thing to happen in urban Los Angeles. We live in Van Nuys, like I've said.
And they're still there, right?
And it's because we have so many feral cats and everybody feeds the feral cats. Yeah. And the coyotes are like, either I'm going to get cat food or a free cat. And
the studio where we record It's Storytime with Will Wheaton is in Van Nuys. And it is in the middle of like just a colony of feral cats.
Insane.
They're when I park and get out of the car, like they haven't yet figured out like, oh, you're cool, right? They're like, you're a person, you're a human, and we choose the bear. And I'm like, I get it. But there's so many of them. Come around and just like
Are they the black ones, a little like sort of half stash? Do you have the
like little tuxedos?
Yeah. It's a lot of them have just a half, like just one white half mustache.
Yeah. These cats, the majority of them, like they're big, you know, they're big like ragdolls or Maine Coons or like those real
because
big.
There's plenty of food. Los Angeles is chop chop. Yeah. Let's get these cats some food. My ad. I'm about to do an ad. It's me, Jackie Cation Rangers. And here is how I love to buy protein usually. I like to go to a butcher and I like them to cut it up in front of me and I like to see it all. But for some reason, that is not happening. So I have turned to Omaha Steaks because the quality is always good. I'm not going to lie to you. I like all of it. I like beef. I like pork. I like chicken. I like salmon. I like fish. I like all the things. And they wrap them up individually so I can freeze them in small pieces. I can defrost them in small ways. And then I can cook them. I just made a couple of filet mignons, which was a little fancy for me. I don't eat a lot of beef. I love chicken. But I do love an occasional filet mignon. And we just did it in a cast iron pan with some butter and some oil, salt and pepper. Sear it on both sides, medium rare, with some spinach and some pilaf, a little bit of rice. So that's what I did there, and I like it. I like it all. So it's convenient, it's quick, they send it to me, and you can have anything. They even have dessert now, so they will deliver it to your door. So there you go. I recommend it because it's good, and here's the scoop on it. You can taste the Omaha Steaks difference and never settle for grocery proteins again. You can get flavorful, high-quality proteins delivered by visiting omahasteaks.com, plus $35 off when you use the promo code DORK at checkout. That's omahasteaks.com, code DORK. Terms apply. See the site for detail. You're all doing great. Let's get back into the show.
I forgot to wrap up my scaly-breasted Munia.
Please.
Thing is that they are an invasive species. I love them. They're beautiful, but they're not native. They were brought here, and I don't remember where they originally came from. I should have written that down. But they're technically an invasive species. They don't compete for resources. They haven't upset the ecosystem at all. So they've kind of like naturalized here in Southern California. But they're not from here. Nor right. are the finches that are the house finches that are everywhere. They're from Mexico. And they have migrated. They've migrated up here. I just thought that was really cool.
I can recognize a finch and a sparrow, though I sometimes get them mixed up. But they're very pretty. Yeah. You say that you get into birds, I will sometimes go, "Oh, look, the birds!" And I'm on the cusp of falling for some birds here.
The goal when I started to care about birds.
Mm-hmm.
This really started when the murder of crows moved into the neighborhood.
Right.
I'd been watching videos for years of people who had befriended corvids, and I knew how smart corvids were, and I knew lots about them. Like, I can really nerd out about corvids.
What's a corvid?
A corvid is a species that crows, ravens, jackdaws, and grackles are all part of.
Okay.
So, and there are... Each species has its own personality quirks and like wonderful, unique identifiers. But all corvid species essentially follow the same big behavior patterns, which is they live in groups and they can remember your face. They really know who you are. They like you or they don't like you. They will hold grudges if you suck. They tell their offspring.
They beat up this car. There's a car that is parked underneath an orange tree in our neighborhood. If it's parked under that car, they will dive bomb that car and dent the hell out of it. It's weird.
One of my neighbors would put a little bit of bird seed out on their driveway to feed not crows for some reason. I don't know why they didn't want to feed the crows, but they fed everything but the crows. And when the crows went after the bird feed, one of them went out and was like, "Get away from my bird feed." The next day, the crows had completely, and I mean completely, torn apart and absolutely destroyed the cover on their car. They destroyed it. They shredded it. When the crows moved in, I remember saying to Anne, "You know those people who sit in the park and feed birds? The birds didn't just suddenly become like their friends. They didn't just show up, right? Like
right.
they invested something in this." And I said, I'm going to get to know these birds. And I started doing friendship with the crows, and that went on for a few months. And then an unkindness of ravens moved in and chased the crows away. This is apparently not that uncommon. But about 4 years ago, maybe the ravens moved in. 3 or 4 years ago, the ravens moved in, and they have not left. And we have absolutely befriended and can very clearly identify at least three who live in the neighborhood. And they have, it is the coolest thing. These ravens love my wife. So there are, do you want me to go into like, okay, we're going to go down. This is going to be Will Talks About Corvids.
Yeah. You have 25 minutes to talk about whatever you want.
please.
Maybe it's all Corvid talk.
Feel free to stop me when this gets too obscure. But so these are things that I have since learned about Corvids.
Okay.
They're incredibly intelligent. They live on average. Ravens live average about 30 years.
Wow.
They remember people. They remember individual people, and they remember your face. And they know
better than me.
If you're cool or you suck. I know, right? Like, it's the number of people who I know too well to say I have completely forgotten your name, but there's no easy way to be like, hey, what's your name anyway?
Right. I consistently reintroduce myself, and I do it, and everyone's like, I know who you are. And I'm like, that is my hint that you should also do that for me. How about, hey,
do you
I'm
have
Jackie.
This, do you have the agreement with your husband of like, if I introduce you to somebody, your job is to say, hey, what's your name? Ann and I have the same agreement.
It's one of the
great ways couples bail each other out, right?
Right. And it's all I can do. And I'm going to interrupt the Corvid talk very briefly to tell you that my friend Laura House and I have that face thing so bad.
I love Laura House, by the way. We wrote together at Acme Comedy Theater. She's amazing.
She's amazing. She's the best.
Brilliant. So funny.
Yes. And so we were having coffee 2 weeks ago, and I was telling her that coming back on the plane, Andy watched Begonia, the Oscar-nominated Begonia.
Yeah.
And I did not, because I don't want to. Mm-hmm. And it looked scary. I wasn't interested. And plus, I have turned my seat into a Dave and Buster's meets a library. I travel too much.
Amazing. Like you read books and get tickets.
I watch them, an old movie, sometimes Stand By Me with captions, and I'm listening to music, and I have a book and then a hardcover book or a paper book. And then I have, in my other hand, my video games. And so that they have led people off of airplanes in handcuffs. And I was like, what happened? And somebody said, somebody was real a bother, I guess. And I said, you know, they didn't bother this one right here.
Yeah.
Anyway, but I saw Begonia from the side, and I have that thing where I don't recognize anybody.
Yeah.
So I said, was Brad Pitt in that movie?
Right.
And it was Jesse Plemons.
Yes.
And Laura House said, you mistook Brad Pitt for Jesse Plemons. And I was like, I don't know. He's had the same haircut. And she goes, you are not a heterosexual woman. And, and I was like, that feels a little harsh on Jesse Plemons. And she's like, he's sexy, but he is not handsome. And I was like, fair enough. Okay, whatever's happening. So ever since then, and I saw her Saturday night, every time, she would go, don't look down, Jackie, but Brad Pitt is right behind you. Just any blonde guy. She's just like,
that's so funny. That's a great bit.
So I have no facial recognition, unlike Corvids. Corvids?
Yeah.
All right.
So I will tell you how we know this, because I think it's the coolest, most amazing thing ever. There's a thing called the University of Washington Corvid Study. And if I have the dates correctly, in the 70s, there were some ornithologists were doing some behavioral research. And in the quad at the university, there are just lots and lots of ravens. And these researchers wanted to capture and banned them so that they could keep track of them. And
rude. Just remember me is what the Ravens
like,
say.
Right. They do not like to be captured. So what they did was when the grad students went out to, you know, to capture them, they wore this mask, a big kind of like ridiculous Halloween mask of like a big caveman, you know, with like a big prominent, like big red nose and like big googly eyes. Like it kind of looked like one of those Ed Big Daddy Roth caricatures from the 70s, right? So
they're
wearing that mask and they're capturing the corvids and they're banning them and letting them go. And the corvids begin, whenever somebody comes out with this mask on, they start dive bombing that person. And corvids do this thing called mobbing, and it's where they have a particular call, and if a corvid within air can hear it, they stop whatever they're doing and they answer the call. And then the raven that called them, or the corvid that called them, is like, this hawk needs to go away from my nest, or this this coyote is bothering us, or this person is capturing us and banding us, and we need to make a stop. So like they start and they do that. And I've watched two ravens mob and harass and chase away a significantly larger hawk in the neighborhood. Like they're just, they do not mess around. So every time somebody comes out with this mask on, the corvids just start attacking thing, you know, like go away. They take the mask off. The same person who had just been getting mobbed takes the mask off, goes back out. Corvids do not look at them a second time. They don't pay any attention to them at all. The researchers figure out, okay, they know who that is. Here's the thing that's really fascinating about this. A number of years go by. Enough time goes by that the ravens who were initially exposed, or the corvids, I don't know if it's only ravens, the corvids who were initially exposed to the researchers in that mask, they have since died. Now we have their offspring. Their offspring are bombing at the mask years later.
Okay.
So this study concludes that ravens and crows teach their offspring. They pass down generationally who they like and who they don't like. And there will be there are stories online of people who are like, I chased the raven out of my yard, and or I chased the crow out of the, you know, out of the garden or whatever. And people are like, you fucked up, man. Like you just made you literally made yourself an enemy of your life.
Right.
So they've done it twice, gone back with the mask, separated by like literal generations of corvids. And they know, they remember, they pass it on. Corvids live intergenerationally in a nest. This is the thing that I love the most. And this will talk about the Kevins, who are my wife's friends. So a parents will have a fledgling, and then they raise it and it lives in the nest and it stays for a year. Most birds, as I understand it, they take off after just a few weeks, but they'll live in the nest for a year, and they help essentially an elder sibling helps to raise the next year's babies. So like you have like, right? So you have kind of like a teenager kind of giving, like walking the kid around and teaching the kid like, all right, we don't like them, we love them.
Right.
Who generally shows up here? Here's how we deal with a blah, blah when it comes, whatever. So about 2 years ago, when the ravens moved in, I noticed that this one raven just kept coming around, just kept coming back and kept coming back. And I was able to recognize them because they had a real interesting notch in their flight feathers. And it just kept coming back and kept coming back. So we were just giving it peanuts and talking to it when we, you know, go for our walks. And I just made, you know, you can make all these, there are sounds that humans can make that corvids are like, hey, you're that's deeply offensive in my language, but I appreciate that you're trying to meet me where I'm at.
It's like trying to speak French in Paris. Good for them.
Exactly. Ravens are a little more forgiving, a little more understanding. This bird just kept coming around. And then we noticed about 5 months ago, right around that, they're showing up with a smaller raven.
Like the youth.
And we think, oh gosh, maybe that's that's their sibling. So we start calling that one Little Kevin, right? We have a bird bath in the yard because of course we do.
Of course.
And we noticed that Big Kevin was catching baby birds and rodents and kind of tearing them apart a little bit and then dumping them into the bird bath for Little Kevin to go and learn how to eat.
Right.
And learn how to, like, you know, how to prepare their food or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so over the months when we're out, when we were walking Marlo, when we're walking ourselves, they fly around and they follow us now. And we throw them peanuts. The corvids love to eat peanuts.
In the shell.
Yeah. Yeah.
They like to,
it's very satisfying for them to open up the shell and take the peanut out. And they'll let you know that they're like, hey, thank you for this. And what they'll do is they'll pick up the peanut and then they will fly right past you so you can see them. Right. And then they'll land in front of you and be like, here we go. So Ann and I subscribe to all these corvid accounts, you know, on all the social networks. And I'm like, babe, we're going to be able to feed them. We're going to be able to hand feed them. It's going to happen. We just got to keep going. About 2 weeks ago, Anne walked out into our front yard, and there was Little Kevin. And Big Kevin's not, we haven't seen Big Kevin in a couple of weeks. So we think maybe he or she moved on, and now Little Kevin is left in the neighborhood. And Little Kevin flies down to the peak of our roof and starts talking to my wife. And Anne has in her hand some salmon skin and a little bit of cooked salmon on it. And she pulls it up on a fork and just sets it on the fence next to where she's standing. And Little Kevin flies down, lands on the fence about 3 feet from her, and then is looking at her, and then walks sideways up the fence, still looking at her, gets pretty close to her, leans down, picks up the salmon skin and like eats it. Right. She's
right.
Like, do you want? And then he sits there and looks at her.
Right.
She's like, you want some more? And she puts it out on the fork. And he hops up and takes off the fork. And she's like,
oh.
And I'm watching all of this through the window. You know, like I can't, if I go outside, like we know.
It'll be too much. Yeah.
Right. It would just be like, I don't know about this guy.
Yeah.
And then she has like some scrambled eggs or whatever. And she just has some scrambled eggs, like, you know, in her fingers like this.
Yeah.
And they lean over and just take it right out of her hand. And every day since then, and I think it's been a couple of weeks. I don't know exactly how long. I exist in trauma time and grief time where like a day feels like a year and an hour never happened. So I don't really know how time is happening right now. Okay. But every day since that happened, in the mornings and again in the evenings, Little Kevin is in the yard or on the telephone pole behind our house, definitely calling to us. She comes out. They have this exchange. And the thing is, like, if everything we understand about corvids is correct, if we understand it correctly, it's like, I think maybe we've made a lifelong friend.
Very possible. If they live for 30 years, like, you're going to be 80. So
we haven't gotten any gifts yet. They will bring, I know this, from reading corvid fan forums. I'm such a dork.
I thought it was going to be corvid fan fiction. And I was like, and I'm not saying it doesn't exist.
it crept up on me so slowly, you know, like it was just for the first couple of years, it was just having walks and seeing birds and being like, oh, those are black phoebes. They're really cool. They swoop down into the grass and they eat birds. I mean, they eat bugs. I know that. Right.
Or right. Like, right.
Oh, I really know the difference now between like a sparrow and a finch. Like I can very clearly see, you know,
right. Very different. I think there was like a, I don't know if it was a bluebird or if it was just had a blue feather. Yeah. I have two questions that I came up with while you were telling the tales. of birds.
Yeah.
Eye color. Are most birds' eyes black?
I think so. Yeah.
Okay. I've not seen another color.
I just saw this picture the other day, and I think it's my next tattoo. Corvids have humans perceive corvids as having jet black feathers, occasionally with a little bit of blue, and very rarely some like purple iridescence that kind of comes up, you know, depending on how they're scattering light.
That's what I think.
The way that they appear to other corvids, the most satisfying way for you to discover this is to just look it up. Look up how corvids see other corvids. They are an explosion of color. They're so gorgeous. They are they are alive with the most beautiful purples and blues, and they are so unbelievably colorful and beautiful. And it's because our eyes and corvid eyes work differently, and like how we see, you know, light or what, you know, that kind of thing. But the way they see each other, oh God, I wish we could see corvids the way they see each other. Cause it's just,
how do they know?
It's just the way that they see them. It's the way that their eyes like receive the light and the refraction, you know, different things. And apparently this is real common in all avian species, that it's very common for them to appear to humans and other potential predators, especially the females. Like they're just sort of like, they're unremarkable and they're real good at just disappearing into their environment so they can protect their nests. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's very common that they are just like, take your breath away, like almost psychedelically vibrantly colored to one another, which I just think is really cool.
That is very cool. And then here's my other question. One time, 20 years ago, I think when I, because my father-in-law was he was a birder guy. Mm-hmm. He had books though, because it was 20 years ago. And Clyde Ashcraft, the first guy that I ever knew who had a GPS, thing.
Oh yeah,
in I had Arkansas. One of those too.
Like a Garmin that was a separate thing.
Right. And I was like, why do you have this? It wasn't even Garmin. It was some other, and he lived next to a national forest in Arkansas. And I said, why do you have this? And he goes, oh, just to remember where I planted my pot. And I was like, this, all right,
that's
then.
Terrific.
Yep. Yeah, yep. And that's good idea. Don't visit it a lot. Otherwise the DEA, there's a pathway. Who knows? He has since passed. But here's the scoop on Clyde Ashcraft is he suggested this book that I read, and I read it. I think it was written in 99 or 2001. It's called The Big Year. And
that
it was
familiar to me.
It's about birders and there used to be a contest that was done with bird watchers of who had seen the most birds in a year. It probably still exists, but the way they did it in the late 90s and previously was before sort of cell phones and the internet and all that. Oh, and 9/11. So they could get on, they would find out through like alt. Message boards, right?
Of course,
A bird Using was seen, was seen in the middle of Alaska. And so the big year was about this guy, and you don't know if he wins until the end of the book. And honestly, I can't remember. So feel free
to
read it.
That sounds terrific. I'm writing that down because I want to read that.
Yeah, and it was written in like 99 or 2000. The big year,
awesome.
A tale of man, nature, and foul obsession. I don't know, but I'm always looking for a good nonfiction book to send my dad, and because he is 89 and trapped in his house.
Can I recommend one of the most satisfying nonfiction books I've ever read?
Yes, please.
That he might enjoy. Okay, so this is an older book called A Voyage for Madmen or A Journey for Madmen. I can't remember which word it is. In the late 1960s, the Times of London sponsored a sailing contest, and it was to go all the way around the world. And you had to go around the three major capes in the Southern Ocean, and whoever you could not make landfall. You had to go without stopping, and it started in Southern England, and then the idea was you would sail down Africa around the Cape and then go around the planet and then come back up through the Pacific at the end. A bunch of people entered this race. One person finished it. Each person who they focus on some stories from some of the people who were involved in this race. And each one of them is remarkable. You have people who are heroic. You have people who are deeply tragic. Like, you just know it's not going to go well for them. The true story. And it's at a time when, like, GPS doesn't exist. Satellites are, like, you know, there's probably a few dozen satellites in orbit.
Around that time. So they have to literally in sailboats.
Yeah. Yep. And they're going around the world, and the way that they're like transmitting their location via radio to different things. They're checking in with cargo ships in shipping lanes to, like, confirm where they are. It's such a wonderful story. I really wanted to figure out there was a moment in the late 90s where I really wanted to figure out a way to turn this into a series. I don't know that it works as a scripted series, but I think there's a really great multi-part documentary series to be made about these, because each episode could focus on one of the people involved. Anyway, it's one of those things that, like, I grabbed it out of a bookstore just because the cover looked interesting, and I could not put it down. And especially if he can't get out, you know, if he's sort of like, look, I'm at home, he might enjoy it. It was just very much like, you know, there's like the big stories. There's, like, man against man against nature, man against himself. Every one of those stories is told within the narrative of this thing. And it's not a huge book. It's only a couple hundred pages. That's perfect. Yeah.
I will definitely look into that, because, like, I've sent him, my sister sent him the history of the rebellion in Iran in the late 70s. And I was like, that's not as light as what he wants. I sent him a book about the first black jockey in horse racing.
Yes.
I sent him a book about how Meyer Lansky tried to turn Havana into Vegas in the inadvertently chose the year that Castro took power. Guess what didn't work? Anyway,
that's what they're trying to do again.
Right. I mean, it's Havana Nocturne should be a tale of I hope they all slip on a banana peel and we roll their bodies into the sea.
Oh, man.
I'm so full of rage. I can't even express.
May their milk always be warm.
always.
May they step on Legos rancid every night on their way to the bathroom.
I used to think I was a pacifist. Turns out I've never been a pacifist. Weird. I just looked up the definition of it. So we have talked for an hour about many things, I think, but a lot of bird talk. This was nice. Well, in 20 years of doing the Dork Forest, this is only the third time anybody wanted to talk about birds.
Really?
It's kind of interesting. Yeah.
It sneaks up on you, man. Like, people kept telling me, man, when you're in your 50s, one day you walk out and suddenly you just really care about birds. And I was just like, come on, that's never going to happen. And then it does. And it's just, you know, there's just something fun. It's kind of like being on a treasure hunt all the time. You're never not.
It's Pokemon Go, but real.
You're never not playing this game. There are thousands of bird species in the world, but it's finite. There's, like, it is possible for a human being in our lifetime to see one of every bird. That is a possible thing. And I just saw a video the other day of two dudes who have been going around the world for years trying to just see however, you know, to get all of the birds. And there's a small number of people and they've almost done it. Like there's something like, I thought it was like 20,000 different species of birds in the world. Anne says she thinks it's a little bit less than that, but these people have gone and they've seen they're down to like a few hundred left. Right.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And this video is them. I don't remember where they are. I think it's in somewhere off the, maybe it's like an island off the coast of west coast of Africa. And they're just like, there's a bird that is, this is the only place in the world where this bird is. And we've been trying to see it and we're trying to see it. And they, of course the bird shows up when the cameras aren't rolling. So the footage is of the camera just like trying to grab the frame and this bird just shoots across the frame and they're like, that was it. That was it. And these people, man, like think about how excited you were that one holiday where you got whatever it was, the ultimate thing, you know, that's what these guys look like. And I was, and the thing is I could really, really, really relate. But for me, that was like, oh, there's a towhee in the backyard. Come check it out. There's a cowbird on the wall. Oh my God.
Rangers, we've been talking with Will Wheaton. Will Wheaton, of course, is WILWHEATON, and it's at It's Will Wheaton. It'll be in the notes. It's Will Wheaton on all the socials. It's Storytime Podcast is going to be about stories, you guys. There's going to be some stories told.
Every week, it's a new piece of speculative fiction. From every episode is less than an hour because nobody has time anymore. And what I'm doing is I'm working with an amazing editor, a content editor named Michael Thomas, who is the editor of Uncanny Magazine. And I asked Michael to find me really remarkable works of speculative fiction, sci-fi, fantasy, and weird fiction that. A mainstream audience probably doesn't know much about. People who are into the speculative fiction world will definitely recognize a lot of these authors. But if you're not already reading Clark's World and Lightspeed and Uncanny, you probably don't even know who these folks are. But I'm doing my best to promote the arts and promote artists. And I am hoping that I can introduce authors to their new biggest fans who just don't know that they exist just yet. So episodes come out every Wednesday, wherever you get your podcasts. And we have a Patreon where I do a lot of behind the scenes stuff. My director and I get together and we have kind of like a talk before we start recording where we talk about the themes and the choices we're going to make and what we're going to do. We save my bloopers because I, mess up all the time. I am one of my great skills is to completely mispronounce a totally normal word that doesn't make any sense at all. That's at patreon.com/storytime. It's a lot for your audience to remember.
Go to willwheaton.net,
you'll find out everything you need to know. And Jackie, I'm really grateful that you asked me to do this. I had so much fun the last time I did your show. And like you come across your stand-up sets come across my dash like all the time.
I'm grinding it out, Will.
They know that the algorithm knows that I enjoy your jokes. So it keeps showing them to me.
Yay!
So it's terrific to be here. And I just really appreciate you like giving me an opportunity to just let people know that this thing that I'm working really hard on that I really love exists. I'm hopeful that somebody else who is weird about birds the way I am will get in touch with some fun bird stuff that I don't even know about just yet.
Joe's, you get a chance. Joe Zimmerman did an episode about birds.
Yeah.
And then one other person did an episode about birds. There's three Dork Forest now about birds. And Zimmerman's a huge fan of getting up at 5 a.m. and going somewhere and looking at birds because he's on the road all the time. He's a great comic. You would actually really like him.
When you run into somebody who loves birds the way I love birds, when I run into somebody else like that, when Ann and I were on our way to Moab recently, we were in Northern Arizona and, I could hear this bird on the other side of a tree and I couldn't see it. I was like, God, that bird sounds so familiar. What is that? And I left my phone in the car and I was like, oh God, what is it? and I'm like talking through, you know, I'm like naming the birds that I know and listening. And a guy next to me is looking at his phone. And he goes, oh, it's a blue jay. And I can't remember the exact subspecies of blue jay it was. And I was just like, oh my God, thank you. It was going to vex me for the rest of the day that I couldn't identify it. And he was like, thank you so much. I was really going to drive me crazy. And he was like, I got you, buddy. I totally understand. And it was just this moment, you know, every now and then you run into somebody who is weird the way you're weird about the same thing. And you have a little moment where you're weird together and then you go your own weird ways. I really enjoyed that as weird about birds.
Yay. And Rangers, you know the rules out there. Take care of each other.
My hat, my hat, my hat. They're dancing around my hat. My hat, my hat, my hat. Well, what do you think of that? If it looks like a Mexican hat dance and it sounds like a Mexican hat dance, it's most likely a Mexican hat dance. So take off your hat and let's dance.
Yay! Oh, my God. Why don't we just call that as the end of the show?